Okay, maybe you could just welcome Anne-Marie.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Anne-Marie Hill. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council. And I'll just take a minute or two of your time so we can be quick. House File 4063, and I apologize, this is the first time I'm taking a look at this, is my request within the agency to be able to meet by teleconference if necessary, or to have board members be able to teleconference. We attended a seminar a workshop put on by the Department of Finance and the Attorney General and several other people this fall, and one of the things they informed us is that in order to be able to teleconference, we have to have it written in statute. I would like that option for our board members to accommodate anybody who has, you know, the physical need to call in, but also for any kind of budgetary reasons in the future. That's my
very,
reason.
Very,
absolutely, and all over the state.
Save money and energy and time.
And time. So, okay. And I did double check with the Attorney General just to make sure I heard her correctly that you do have to have it written in statute. You do. So.
Okay.
This is my reason for being here. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It says in the language that all votes are conducted by roll call, so each member's vote on each issue can be identified and recorded. So even the superfluous, everything's going to be, every single issue that's going to be brought up is going to be on a roll call basis. Is that what we're saying for your meeting that you're going to be taking, or is it just going to be on pertinent information dealing that deals for which the meeting was called? Meaning, you have to do. I don't know what exactly that all means. Is it going to be that intensive? Is that the way all meetings like this that are done through electronic means conducted?
No, I wouldn't. All votes conducted by roll call, so each member's vote on each issue can be identified and recorded. Well, I would say if it was electronically, that perhaps. I'll have to check on that for you.
Well, that's a concern, I guess.
Yeah, sure.
Because I can see where, as time goes on, years go by, all of a sudden you're just this really isn't pertaining to the issue that we're discussing. This is kind of part of the ongoing minutes process of, approving the minutes. Are you going to approve the minutes on a roll call basis every time you get together, or is it just going to be a matter of, unanimous vote or something like that? But according to this here, it says all votes conducted by roll call, so each member's vote on each issue, it can be identified and recorded. And that's, you're going to go, gosh, we don't have to approve the minutes on a roll call basis, do we? But that's the way the language is written.
Well, I suppose if you teleconference, you would have to identify each individual if you were on teleconferencing, but I don't foresee. I mean, maybe in the future there might be an instance where you have to teleconference everybody in, but I guess if you look at this, it's probably going to be used rarer than not. Also, there are a lot of meetings where we can go through the entire meeting and we perhaps vote on one issue, and that's it, because we don't have to take up a vote on every issue that we do. That's just there. There's no requirement per se. There's language in the statute that says what a quorum is, how you establish it by the majority of the members. But if you were teleconferencing, if we were on a teleconference right now, I would have to know who voted to be able to write it accurately in the meeting minutes to represent that. We would always have somebody taking that accurate note. Does that answer the question,
Mr. Chair? Mariana, is it Mariana?
Yeah, Anne-Marie.
Anne-Marie. My concern is that later on, where things could get so you just take it for granted, and all of a sudden things that were supposed to be according to statute now become those guidelines are basically not adhered to. So I just want to make it
right. Representative Yarrow, Representative Anderson, not under my administration. So the only thing I would have definite concern, and I would make sure it was always met, is that we met regardless the open meeting requirements with regards to this if we were going to meet sometime entirely by teleconferencing. So we do our very best to meet all the statutory requirements for the public.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hill, I just you won't be there forever, but whoever your predecessor and everybody else, just for the record, that it gets notated that. Hopefully.
Representative Anderson, Amita says that it's a standard language that's used for these kinds of bills.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, Representative Erdl?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill, since I'm signed on to it, I'm sure it's a very good bill. question is, how many meetings do you have in a year, and how many times would you anticipate doing it in this manner?
Anticipation, I really can't say. Perhaps once in midsummer, if someone doesn't want to travel and it's a lengthy way to go, or perhaps in the winter time. Once in the winter time, we have a total of on the schedule. We have a total of 4 meetings, one per quarter, that meet January. Whatever the quarter is, January, April, October, no, I'm missing one, so July and October, and that's how we are currently meeting. We can call special meetings, which we did call in February, so there would be 5 total meetings this year.
Thank you.
That's how we currently conduct business.
Okay. I think we have...
We'll consider House File 4063 for the. This is going to become the omnibus bill because. So, okay.
Okay.
If there is an omnibus. Okay, thanks, Emery.
Thank you.
Representative Doty, you have somebody from out of town. How about Representative Diane Lawson? Okay, you could. Welcome. House File. Wait, 2706, Representative Doty. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, members, when I was. 8 years old, I got a box in the mail from a great aunt, and one of the things in that box was a collection of letters that my great grandfather wrote home from the Civil War, and they were wonderful stories about escorting General Sherman, about his wound, about taking the troops out to forage, and everything about what the war was really like, about what happened to deserters in his camp. At some point after I got to be 8 years old, I realized I was really, really lucky because I had gotten the stories that my family had to tell. House File 2706 is an attempt to do that for the next generation. It's to appropriate some money so that the Military Museum at Camp Ripley can interview the men and women that are returning today so that we don't lose their stories before it's too late. I have with me today Jack Johnson, who is a former curator and present vice president of personnel at the museum, and I'll turn it over to him for explanation. Thank you.
Welcome. Identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Doty, my name is Jack Johnson, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Military Museum, which is located at Camp Ripley. I'm a member of the Board of Directors of the Military Historical Society of Minnesota, which operates the museum. We are requesting a one-time appropriation of $184,500 for fiscal year 09 to aid in documenting the military service of Minnesota men and women. That amounts to half of the difference between what we had hoped to receive for the biennium last year and what was actually appropriated. If I might, I'd like to provide a little background and context. Our mission is to enhance public understanding of how armed conflicts and military institutions have shaped our state and national experience. We do this by documenting, preserving, and depicting military history as it was experienced by Minnesotans who served in all branches of service or on the home front in time of peace and war from our earliest frontier years up until the present time. We operate on a very lean budget. We have no full-time staff. On the surface, the museum has done remarkably well, but there's a flip side to our success. With more requests for help, more artifacts, more books and archival materials, and ever higher public expectations. These growing expectations and an urgency born of accelerating change in the military presents for us a troubling dilemma, hitting what we should do in light of our mission and recent historical developments against what we can do given existing resources. One such change is the transformation of the Minnesota National Guard from a strategic reserve force to a fully integrated part of the active Army and Air Force. There's also been a steady expansion of military assignments worldwide for the U.S. military. You've heard all about it. Peacekeeping missions, counterinsurgency operations, military occupation duty, humanitarian relief, homeland security, U.S. border security, disaster response, a steady procession of flare-ups elsewhere in the world, and ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. All of these have stretched our military capabilities to the limit. For example, in the past 10 years, nearly every member of the Minnesota Army National Guard has been federalized at least once. Since 9/11, most members of Minnesota-based Army, Air, Navy, and Marine Corps Reserve units have been mobilized at least once for federal active duty. The history of these deployments and of Minnesotans serving in the active forces needs to be systematically documented. Exhibits that explain what is going on and that tell the stories of these Minnesotans need to be created. It falls to the Minnesota Military Museum to do this work. It is expected of us. We've done an excellent job with the resources we have, but we have only one half-time curator, not nearly enough to appropriately record, conserve, and care for more than 30,000 artifacts, document and record histories, and develop new exhibits while keeping ongoing exhibits fresh and up to date. The backlog of new artifacts that need processing keeps mounting. The museum lacks a computerized database for its artifacts. There are many things we can and should do to improve programming and outreach, but it all requires staff time and specialized expertise. We've made heavy use of volunteers, but volunteers can only do so much. They require training, oversight, and direction from professional staff. We face a real dilemma. How can we reconcile our current capabilities with our certain conviction that we need to support our state-oriented mission and appropriately honor our current Minnesota service members and veterans by preserving their story? We truly are at a critical turning point in our own history as a museum, and that brings us to you. We need more funding to, one, strengthen our collection and its management. Two, to proactively document and educate the public about the recent military deployments and personal experiences of Minnesota's servicemen and women. Three, to rework existing exhibits and create new ones. Four, to expand our educational outreach. And five, to increase administrative support. Our long-term vision is to have one of the best state military museums in the nation, a dynamic institution that properly honors Minnesota's veterans while providing genuine value to the citizens of the state. We seek to stay true to our mission and to our vision. With your support, we believe strongly that we can. I thank you, and we're here to answer any questions you may have.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Johnson. How many military museums are there in Minnesota? I know we have one in northeastern Minnesota. They wanted 100,000, and they were gonna match if they got. But I told them we're broke. We have about $1 billion deficits, and so they decided to wait and see if we can.
The only military-related museums that I'm aware of are the historic sites and so on that are part of the Minnesota Historical Society. And we also have the Minnesota Air Guard Museum, which is not directly connected to the Minnesota Historical Society.
Oh, okay. Okay. Representative Erdo?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This comment that in Litchfield we have a Grand Army of the Republic Hall. I don't know if that would...
I have heard of it, and it's one I've always wanted to go see.
I don't know if it qualifies exactly as a military museum, but it's basically the VFW Hall or American Legion of the Civil War Veterans, and we have one of only three that's left in the nation in Litchfield, and it's as it was then. So technically, I guess that's a military museum.
Technically, I think it is, yes.
Rosanna Maldori.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I just have two questions. The first thing, you know, we toured last year the Historical Society, and they've done a tremendous amount of improvements in their storage capabilities, their database development, that sort of thing. Isn't some of the work that you're doing duplicative of the work that they're already doing, and have you researched ways to find out if we can better utilize their more vast resources and perhaps allow you to have a little bit more flexibility in your funding requests? Or
we do work closely with the Minnesota Historical Society. They've been very helpful in many ways to us. I think in particular in our curator, Doug, Becky here can talk about it because she works both for us and does work for the Minnesota Historical Society. But our mission is very focused on Minnesota military history only. That's the only thing that we do. And, of course, the State Historical Society has many things on its plate. And so, yes, they do some things related to the military, but that's our only focus. And we do try to work as closely as we can with them. That's all I can say.
Mr. Chair, can I just one more follow-up? The computer system that you're looking at, again, you know, we've got a real problem in this state in that everybody seems to have their own little thing. And then when there comes a point when we want to merge everything, we end up having to spend millions of dollars. We're doing this right now in the Department of Vehicle Services and trying to figure out how to integrate that system. Are you working with the Historical Society to be sure that the database that you're setting up in fact will work with the database collection that already exists with the Historical Society?
When that time comes, when we're able to begin to build such a database, yes, we would certainly want to dovetail with them. The military has the military museum system, of which we are a part, has a system that they would like to see us adopt as well. There are other possibilities in addition. But when the time comes, and I hope it's sooner rather than later, yes, we would certainly want to work with them at the Historical Society.
Okay. Representative Norna, is he here?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to add, a few moments ago we were talking about museums, and Perham has a museum, a military museum that's fairly new. My question, I guess, tying into that, I'm wondering if there is anything that your museum might have, or I'm wondering if there's a possibility of some sharing or some traveling exhibits that might help both facilities accomplish.
I believe that's the true here, and I'm going to ask our curator to answer that one, because
we currently have things on loan in the Perham Museum as well as other museums around the state. We loan things widely, and we're currently working with the Minnesota Historical Society. I'm on the advisory board of the Historical Society's Greatest Generation Project, and I'll be working with them. I've got their two main conservators coming to our museum on Thursday and Friday to work with us on flags. So there's a lot of interplay between the
two. Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. I'm very supportive of what you're trying to do today. Okay. Any other questions? So we have three other people: Ray Lundy, Denise Evans, Doug, Becky. And are you testifying for or against the bill? All for. And is there anything you have to add, or is Johnson, Mr. Johnson, and Mr. Lundy?
No. Sir, I'm Ray Lundy. I'm the current chairman of the board of the Minnesota Military Museum. All right. I'd just like to add that.
Oh, come on, do you want to come here?
No. I didn't think that.
Welcome, Mr. Lundy.
Again, I'm Ray Lundy, and I live in Corcoran, Minnesota, and I'm currently the chairman of the board of the Minnesota Military Museum. I'd just like to thank the people that came up to visit the museum from that committee, and also thank the people here in the House and the Senate that the monies that we have gotten so far have been a great help to us, but we need to just get over that hump somehow, and we're just getting further behind all the time, but I want to thank you very much. We're very prudent about money. We do get donations from Legions, VFWs, and other people, and memorials, and we have a very good system in how we allocate all that money, how we spend it. And I want you to know that we're very frugal.
Okay.
And we do a nice job with that.
Yeah, well, thank you. I've been there a couple of times.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there any federal sources or foundations, private or local?
We've been looking into some grants, but those are hard to break into.
Everybody's broke, just like the state, huh?
Yeah, I guess so. But anyway, we look into that. We look at all avenues we can, and we're really a volunteer organization, a blue-collar type operation, and we need some help to get over that hump. If you ever came to our storage rooms, you'd see why. But we better take and document all that. We have very nice displays. We like to get those changed and get them up to date and make some changes. Again, thanks for your help.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Denise Evans and Doug Becky, do you have anything to add? All right. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Doty, well, then you want this bill to go to the Finance Committee, then?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
I hope they are creative.
I hope they are as well.
Maybe we can add my amendment to this. Okay. I'll move that House Law 2706 be recommended to pass and sent to the Finance Committee. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. You are all invited to come up and see the magnificent job they've done with what they have and also the storage sheds full of stuff that we're hoping we can deal with.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes?
Representative Doty, are the Doty letters included in the museum?
They are not. They're in Illinois.
Okay. Well, thank you. Let's see. I think Representative Loeffler, House File 2895.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2895 is a continuing appropriation to, or a one-time appropriation to the Sesquicentennial Commission to continue the planning and implementation of activities in this, the 150th year of Minnesota statehood. And we know that dollars are always scarce to come by here, but we hope that you will agree that the Commission has been working on some memorable activities that I think will live long beyond this year and help shape our future. The Sesquicentennial Commission is composed of 8 legislators and about an equal number of members of the public. Representing the House are myself, Representative Solberg, Representative Maureen Lanning, and Representative Sondra Erickson, with the Senate represented by Senator Ann Reff, Senator Don Betzold, Senator Pat Carousel, and Senator Jen Olson. And this group was honored to last year receive an appropriation of $750,000, which we have dispersed to as directed to make sure that there were activities in all 87 counties around the state, that this was not going to be just a St. Paul-centric sort of event, but that communities throughout the state of Minnesota would have an opportunity to get engaged and involved. And we have been diligently, enthusiastically, and at the expense of our staff and fellows, beating the bushes in terms of the corporate and giving and foundation communities. And I have to say that I think we've been very responsible stewards of our dollars, and that much of the work of our commission is being done by sesquicentennial fellows who are either current students or recent graduates from our higher education institutions who are putting heart, soul, and a lot of youthful energy in to making this successful. Like many entities at this time of a recession and economic challenges, fundraising is challenging, and particularly for something that's connected with government. And I think that the combination of that and a lot of competition has meant that we haven't been able to be as successful as we had hoped, even though we have found some really good, strong partners in the in the business and foundation community, and that's the reason for the for coming back here and asking for additional state dollars. The governor, in his supplemental budget, recommended $1 million. We have already appropriated $175,000 in the supplemental budget that would allow our staff to actually stand payroll past May 11th because we have a year of activities. And so the request at this point would be a maximum of $825,000 in state funding. So just to put it in context, we have also dispersed grants of almost $1 million that have generated $1 million in community match, both in kind and cash. And raised about $500,000 of private funding. So that just kind of gives you the fiscal context. But more importantly, I think it's the program context. What are we going to get, and what's going to be the end result of the sesquicentennial year? And I think we've done a good, responsible job of trying to have not only fun activities, but some things that will really make a lasting difference. And to me, when we first met as a commission, we said, what do we really want to say? What's our measures of success a year from now or 2 years from now when we're looking back? And to me, one of it was that we know our Minnesotans see themselves as one Minnesota. We don't see ourselves as I'm from the range, or I'm from a small town, or I'm from a suburb, or I'm from an exurb, but we see ourselves as Minnesotans, that we see that we have a common history and that we can learn from it, and more importantly, that we can see and envision a common future that we can all work towards together. And so I'm really excited about the fact that we're challenging people throughout the state to help us identify what it is that we want to accomplish long term. We tend to look short term here. We're even asking people, what do you want to have done by the bicentennial 50 years from now? And I think our young people are stepping up and with some pretty creative ideas. With that, I'm going to let Jane Leonard, who's the executive director of the sesquicentennial effort, overview for you what we've done and what we're planning.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Jane Leonard, the executive director of the sesquicentennial commission. I have a short PowerPoint that will give you a pretty good idea of what we've been doing and what's ahead. And then we've got a few handouts. I believe we have some, they're all out. Okay, we have some medallions and a little schedule of events for folks. As Representative Loeffler said, we have been very busy putting the grant money out that the legislature did provide the last session. Over 100 grants have been awarded, at least one in every county. These include micro grants of up to $1,000 and legacy grants, which have averaged about $5,000. We have $270,000 awarded so far, and that's out of the $325,000 that the legislature allocated. And the reason why there's a little discrepancy is we're still waiting for a few budgets to come in, and because we are following the Minnesota Historical Society's accounting and accountability route for the grants. But you can see that, as Representative Loeffler said, the communities and organizations have really stepped up to the plate in terms of local cash matches for these projects. And I just want to give one example, well, a couple examples, actually. The Minneapolis Public Library, for example, received one of the legacy grants for a program called Minnesota Innovation, 150 Years of Ingenuity, about all the patents that have been produced here in Minnesota, and they are the patent library for our state. The White Earth Land Reservation project was awarded a grant as well, a legacy grant, and so we're looking at all of the Ojibwe culture there and the even the biofuels projects that they're working on. So it's really a wide range of things. In addition, they matched this with a $401,000 in-kind or donated services. So we're just really happy that this quadrupled the state investment. And there's many more that didn't get funded, and we'd love to help prime the pump a little bit more and really be a catalyst for that kind of investment in our community. I know you can't see this, I'm going to go right past it, but if you'd like to see a complete list of all the legacy and micro grants, it's on our website, www.mn150years.org, and they are statewide and many here in the metro area as well. Representative Loeffler mentioned something that is a catalyst, really a platform that we're using the sesquicentennial for, which is to plan for our future. And since October, we have been spending time and some of the financial resources to get a snapshot of Minnesotans' hopes and dreams and literally their commitments to the future, literally asking them to think about what do we need to do today to make sure that our future is one of high quality and even higher quality of life than we have now. And so those have been happening across the state and will continue to occur. And we've had over 40 meetings with the help of the Regional Development Commissions, the Extension Service, the Initiative Foundation, this really will form kind of a blueprint document that will be put together with some of the work that the Citizens League has done, the Minnesota Anniversary Project that they've done, and other groups that are looking at our future, including, I understand, maybe the Minnesota Milestones as part of the state of Minnesota. We are also going to be looking at the plan for our future during the Capitals for a Day week, which is May 11th to the 18th. During Statehood Weekend, the 17th and 18th, and then throughout the state fair at our special sesquicentennial tent, the newest attraction on the state fairgrounds. So we have an ambassadors council that represents just about every county in Minnesota. It's a liaison to the commission so that we have some eyes and ears out there and help us stay informed of their events and help them stay informed of the events and programs that are underway across the state. Mentioned the Capitals for a Day. This was probably one of the most popular things to happen just before Christmas. We had over 60 nominations from around the state, and we decided to go with the natural resource regions of Minnesota. These are the biomes, the natural areas, because this is something that we do all share. And we are unique in the nation, and in fact in the North American continent, that three major natural resource areas converge: the biomes, the prairie, the deciduous forest, and the coniferous forest. And those of you from northwestern Minnesota know that there's a special area called the Tallgrass Aspen Parklands that is the fourth biome, where Glacial Lake Agassiz was located, and then the driftless area down in southeastern Minnesota where no glacier touched Minnesota, which is why we have the beautiful blufflands there. So this is the sign that everybody gets for the honorary state capital. These are going up. We will be having special days for each of those communities, and we'll be recognizing all the nominees throughout the year with our sesquicentennial spotlight tours of each of the regions. The commission commissioned medallions. These are examples of them. We have actually three medallions. One we made special for the MN-150 exhibit for the History Center. It's not pictured here, but each of the medallions has the sesquicentennial logo, and then a quarter dollar is one side of one version, and then the Great Seal of Minnesota is another one. And we've got some samples here for you in aluminum, which we hand out to school children and other folks that would like to have a sample. We also have them in bronze and special ones in silver. This is the postal stamp. We would have brought it with us, but it was a little rainy, snowy out there, and we're trying to protect it. This is actually at its unveiling, the design unveiling in Winona. This is the Highway 43 bridge in the upper Mississippi River Valley of near Winona. This will be first day of issue here at the state capitol on May 17th at 1 o'clock p.m. And we are hoping to have a second dedication in Minneapolis on June 14th for Flag Day, which will be at the R. Godfrey House. He was the first postmaster of Minneapolis, probably one of the first postmasters in the state. So that'll be a first day issue as part of Statehood Weekend. One of the other events that's happening that just kind of started on its own, and we've been very supportive of it, is Orlin Ospie from Gapsky, Minnesota, which is near Thief River Falls. Orlin was 16 years old during the centennial, and his friend Delmar Hagen did the oxcart journey that year in 1958, and Delmar asked him to promise to do it again in 50 years, and he's keeping his promise. That's loyalty for you. So Orlin is setting out from St. Vincent and will follow as much as possible the historic Pembina Trail to St. Paul with his ox and cart, and he's got two ox in training. They've already outgrown two yokes, and he's made a third one out of a fireplace mantle, so you know these are big animals. But he will hopefully arrive on the first day of the state fair, August 21st, right with the 2 o'clock parade, having come 400 miles in 40 days along the old Pembina Trail, which without that, St. Paul probably wouldn't be a city today without that trade route. So we're happy to help Orlin and his family do this again. We will also be having a Sesquicentennial wagon train starting May 4th as a way to help kick off the whole month of statehood activities. This is a wagon train that is authentic. There'll be 20 wagons, 100 horses. They did the same thing for the Anoka County Sesquicentennial last year. They've done rides for the Courage Center. They will be starting out around Cannon Falls and basically following the river up through to St. Paul and arriving right here at the Capitol on May 11th during the statehood day activities when there's an open house at the Capitol between 1 and 4 p.m. You've heard some, I think, this week especially about the state entry signs. I just happened to see two of them yesterday, one in Wabasha and one in Winona. They look wonderful, and the commission paid for these out of some donations and some of our funding from the state, and we hope that people will buy them back as souvenirs. They're, as my staff likes to say, they're about as big as a twin bed, but they'd be great in a restaurant or in your cabin or someplace as a souvenir, and the DOT will take them down for us at the end of the year. We have a cookbook. Every county has submitted recipes. This will be available at the Minnesota State Fair. This is not the cover. It's just sort of a sample. But we do hope to raise some funds from that. But more so, we're really getting a great picture of Minnesota and its diversity in 2008 through food. And license plates, we had hoped to have license plates, but we understand there's been some difficulty getting those through. And I'd just like to point out that Wisconsin did make $4 million on their license plates when they had their sesquicentennial in 1998. So this is a sample that could happen. We have put out the sesquicentennial flag to every troop installation across the world, thanks to the National Guard. And, in fact, during the statehood weekend, the official ceremony on May 18th, we will have a live satellite hookup with our troops in Iraq, and they'll be able to participate in the ceremony, and they'll also be able to spend that whole weekend talking to their family and friends over that hookup from the Capitol. So we're really happy about being able to provide that for the troops around the world. The State Fair is one of our big events, along with Statehood Week, as I mentioned, May 11th to the 18th. And as Representative Loeffler said, it's been fairly easy to get some money to raise for the State Fair because they know, the marketers know that 1.7 million people come through those gates. And so a lot of people will see this big top tent, and we'll be having the Song of the North Star show and panels on our future. And in addition to that, artist Susan Warner from Minneapolis is working right now with communities across the state on the All-County Mosaic, which will be put up permanently as a commemorative tile mural called Greetings from Minnesota. It won't look like this. This is actually what I believe is in the Crookston, University of Minnesota Crookston hall. But it will be on the food building for everybody to see from here on into eternity. This is our website. This is really our clearinghouse. We try not to use a whole lot of paper. We have everything you need on the website. If it's not there, let us know, and we'll make sure it's listed. This is where you can see all the events. They're listed not only by chronological order, but by location and by type of event, so arts or great outdoors or what have you. Want to just quickly tell you about Statehood Weekend. This is the major weekend because, as you probably know, May 10th and 11th is fishing opener, and it's Mother's Day on May 11th, and Race for the Cure, where 80,000 people will be at the Mall of America, and we didn't want to try to compete with that, so we took the next weekend, and we are going to be, as I said, on the 17th, premiering the stamp. There'll be a flyover of vintage airplanes at 12:30 to herald that. At 1 o'clock, the stamp will be unveiled. On Sunday, we will have the ceremony honoring those who serve, members of armed forces, our public servants, citizen volunteers. We'll have an all-state choir, the Minnesota Symphonia Orchestra, and the National Guard Band, and many speakers to help kick us off into the next 50 years. This is just a sample of what we think the pavilions might be able to look like. This is one of the suggested titles, Minnesota Minds and What They Can Do. It's in part our innovation and our educational bent. And the statehood ceremony will be ending with a spectacular fireworks display behind the Capitol, which hasn't happened for many years since the state of Minnesota moved to Harriet Island. You see Northwest Airlines there. They are not a sponsor yet, but they are on the list. I just want to let you know, because somebody asked me about that at the last year and I was at, but they are under consideration. So we have a long schedule of events, some of which the commission is managing and coordinating, and others that are happening. One of the things that is kind of fun, the Minnesota Twins are going to devote the May 10th Boston Red Sox game to the sesquicentennial. So get your tickets now. They'll have an 1860 style baseball game before the regular game and pregame festivities on the Twins Plaza. And then you can see Statehood Day will feature an open house at the Capitol. The Historical Society has an open house that we are partnering with. And we are hoping to also display during that week one of the 25 remaining copies of the Declaration of Independence that was printed on the evening of July 4th, 1776. So look for that to come at the History Center. There'll be some more information about that coming up in the next week or so. The honorary chapels for day will help us, as Representative Loeffler said, understand that the state is 5 million people and 87,000 square miles, and we're going to see all of it going to see the chapels for a day. We hope some of you can join us. And then you can see some of the other events here that go on into the summer, ending with the state fair, but not necessarily ending at the state fair. There's many other things that we hope will be able to happen into the fall as more of a sort of reflective time about our future. And where we're headed in the next 50 years. We have raised $332,000 from foundations, primarily for our plan for the future related programs and state fair activities. We've raised $215,000 from corporations, although I can tell you today I just got a check from a corporation for one of the events. And another $300,000 that we're anticipating towards Statehood Week and weekend. It is very difficult to raise general operations funding in this environment, particularly if you don't have a history for your event. We've done this 50 years ago, and we'll do it again in 50 more years, but it's not one of those events that fit very well with some of the marketing programs. But you can see a list of some of our partners so far, and you're right on the top of it. Thank you very much. So I will end there just to say that this really is a remarkable opportunity to integrate our commitment to the local community with a kind of collaborative stewardship for the place that we all call home, our state. And the Bush Foundation has awarded a grant to the Sesquicentennial Commission. If we can raise an additional $300,000, anytime after March 4th, they will release the remaining $100,000 of their $226,800 grant that they have awarded to us. And we hope that we're well on our way to that. And I will take any questions.
Well, thank you. Thank you, and thank you to the commission and all the local participants. We gave you some money last year, and then Representative Solberg gave you $175 supplemental and so on. I was wondering if you could do a study on how to solve our deficit problem going up. It looks like we're going up and down. Maybe then we could celebrate better in about 50 years.
I share your vision of having a much more stable funding future for Minnesota, and I think all of us at this point in the legislative process share that dream that we can meet our needs and dream big and have a successful economy all one nice path.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Leonard, Representative Loeffler. I'd just like to commend the Sesquicentennial Commission for what you're doing in light of the fact that I think that you should have been giving you more funding for this. I would support whatever funding we can do at the present time. I mean, you only celebrate a Sesquicentennial every, how many years? 150 years. I was just a baby in the last 100th anniversary. I remember it very well because I was an older baby. But we had the brothers of the brush, I remember. All the men grew beards. than the Sisters of the Swiss, and they had bonnets. I don't know why they called them the Sisters of the Swiss, but they did. And, you know, the local parades, the, I remember kangaroo courts, the towns that really seemed to get into this thing. And I'm hoping that that type of spirit can, you know, move across the state as we get, you know, well, beyond May 11th as well. It continue throughout the year. I think it was a very good thing for the state back in 1858. I am a Meeker County ambassador to the, and just one suggestion that, you know, what we Ms. Leonard and I had a brief chat last week about the state, new state song possibilities. And, you know, it just kind of hit me, the state fair, wouldn't it? That'd be a good time to unveil that.
It's
okay.
Yes. First of all, I'm just wondering, did you have to be able to say Seska, in order to see how many eight? I see why there's only eight.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Madora, I have to say that it was equally hard to say with spelling it.
Yes.
You'll note that our website is min150.
Yes. But I'm wondering, with the parade, with July 4th coming up, and of course all the metro area parades and that sort of thing, are you renting out flags or allowing local units of government perhaps to walk with one of these flags to highlight the celebration? Has that been thought about?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Madore, yes, actually we have a whole array of flags and banners that communities can purchase if they like. We do loan them out on occasion because we've got a few in our office. And actually we're being lobbied hard for July 4th about, you know, being the official place for July 4th. But as you say, so many communities have that. And I'd just like to respond as well to Representative Erdahl. There are right now, and still counting, over 400 different events that are happening across the summer, primarily across the summer, but across the whole year. In fact, the state parks, for example, have 150 new programs that they'll be hosting in the state parks based on the sesquicentennial. The Minnesota Historical Society has a signature event at every one of their historic sites, and there are, as I said, over 400 other events that local communities and organizations have been planning and will produce, some because they received a grant, but others just because, as you said, they want to have, you know, the Swiss Guard, the Swiss Sisters. Yeah, right. So it's really a wonderful outpouring of spirit. And you know, if you can just indulge me in one more, few more seconds here, one of the fun things that we just found out about a couple of weeks ago was that we actually have a sesquicentennial Easter egg at the White House at this minute. Two women from Minneapolis were asked by the American Egg Board to make the official Minnesota Easter egg for the White House Easter egg roll. And that is on display at the White House Visitor Center right now, and it'll be on the website after Easter. And it's a beautiful representation of the sesquicentennial logo. And it even has a border on the top and bottom of the egg that represents the biomes of Minnesota. So we're just thrilled by the egg. That's one of the really neat things that have just kind of popped out of nowhere. So,
Representative Lane?
Do you have any capability of or plans to get information out to the schools, especially fourth graders that are studying Minnesota? This would be a perfect lesson plan for that age group.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and Representative Lane. Actually, we are working in partnership with the Minnesota Historical Society, which has the Northern Lights curriculum, and many of our staff have made lots of visits to fourth, fifth, and sixth graders. In fact, we were just at the Linwood Elementary School. They did the sesquicentennial opera, which was wonderful, and we've invited them to come and do that for the sesquicentennial weekend. They know, as probably Representative Erdahl can attest, more about history than probably a lot of the adults do, and so we're hoping that they can be our ambassadors to help their parents understand, you know, the history and then looking forward. So definitely we're involving the school children.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay, well, thank you very much. I would move that House File
2895 be considered to be placed in the, what should I call it, omnibus, nihilbus bill? Omni means all and nihil means nothing. Almost nihilbus. Bill. The governor has recommended $1 million for this, and $175 will be subtracted because they got a supplemental budget earlier this session, and so we'll just have to.
Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. There's a mo. House file 3356. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This bill's price tag is far more manageable. Nothing. So, members of the committee, I'm just going to briefly introduce the bill, and then I've got two presenters, Joel Johnson from the Congress of Minnesota Resorts and Colleen Tollefson from Explore Minnesota Tourism. In around Minnesota, it's nationally, but specifically in Minnesota, we have a challenge now. We have many challenges to our resorts, but currently many people who are single-family property owners or own several properties are renting their properties out. Real estate offices now are starting to collectively do this, and it's competition for resorters, one, but two, what's more important is that they're doing so outside of state jurisdiction. There's no lodging tax being collected, there's no Department of Health inspections and many other issues that our resorts have to do that these rentals aren't having to comply with. Now, we want people coming up north and staying and spending their money, and so we don't necessarily want to keep this from happening, but we would like to look at the situation and make sure that it's being done in a fair and equitable and safe manner. So the bill before you requires the Explore Minnesota Tourism to do a study, to look at the effects of these seasonal property rentals and what should be done about it. Joel?
Okay, Representative Joel Carlson from Moorhead. Where do you live now?
I'm in Zimmerman. I've been there since 1990.
Oh, wow.
About 10 miles north of Elk River, Mr. Chairman, and a little closer than Moorhead, but I still get there frequently. We still have a lake home there.
Was it 85, 86?
Yep. Sat right next to you. It's a lot of fun. Mr. Welcome. Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and have for a long time represented the Congress of Minnesota Resorts, which is a trade association of small family-owned resort operations in Minnesota. At one time, Minnesota boasted over 3,000 family-owned resorts. We're down to about 900 now. Through a number of reasons, including rising land values and changes in our lifestyle and the ability to make a profit on a three-unit resort. But one of the things that we come to the legislature with on behalf of the Congress is to look at issues that are impacting the tourism business. And this is something that we think is out there. And I just want everybody to know we're not talking about somebody who has a cabin and rents it out for 1 week out of the summer or a month. We're talking about people who are actually in the lodging business that are providing daily, weekly, or monthly rental of lodging to the public. And the only thing that we would like to see is that we define it, we know what it is, and to the extent to protect the public and consumers, that there are regulations that are needed, we address those. But we're not talking about somebody that rents their cabin out once or twice a year, on the lake while they're gone on vacation someplace else. So we'd appreciate your support for this. I think there's a small fiscal note to it that EMT is believe that they can absorb within their existing budget, but I think Colleen was like at $5,000, which I believe they can absorb. We'd appreciate your support.
Did you talk to them? Could they do it without the legislation? Or
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Moe can probably answer that as well. We would like to have this bill passed, even though they could do the study without this legislation. We want to alert cabin owners, local units of government, to the issue, and that's why we brought a bill forward. I think they're aware of this issue. We've had a number of meetings at EMT, at their public policy committee, about this. But we decided to bring this issue to the legislature's attention and have this study brought forward so that legislators are aware of it and that they know that other units of government and affected associations can be involved in the work as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I disagree with what Mr. Carlson said. We believe that other state agencies and the private sector will be more accountable to us if we, in fact, pass legislation as opposed to just having Explore Minnesota Tourism do this. We do have Colleen Tollison here from Explore Minnesota Tourism. If you have money from her for just coming in.
Thank you. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Colleen Tollison with Explore Minnesota Tourism, and I would just want to echo that this brings a lot of visibility to the issue. As an example, I did get a phone call already from a cabin owner wanting to know how this would impact them if it were passed, and I'm sure they wouldn't be paying attention were it not for the legislation. I would have to say that the issue of second home rental has been growing over the past few years, and it's a little bit broader than the cabin by the lake. That's certainly probably the largest area, but we know now that it's also occurring with condominiums throughout the metro area and other places. So I think this is a really good opportunity for us to look at this in sort of a unified way and come out with some common recommendations. We certainly can absorb the cost, and we've been involved in a number of discussions, but I think the other thing that the legislation does is it will give us some leverage for people who haven't come to the table yet, and that would be groups like the realtors that are offering training classes to real estate agents that when they sell the cabins that they're suggesting that they rent them, other things like that. And what we have found is that there isn't any type of communication right now that we're aware of to cabin owners or other second homeowners on what is really required, and we think that would be helpful as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to add that in addition to the concerns for, you know, the resort community and business issues, we also have to really be concerned for clean water, actually, and the implications that this could have on septic systems, because when homes and cabins are sized for a particular usage, oftentimes when this is rented to somebody else, many more people than the building and the septic system are actually capable of dealing with will stay there. And if you have a proliferation of this type of usage, it could impact septic systems and, of course, the lakes that they're located on. Thank you.
Representative
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if this is for Mr. Carlson or Small or somebody, but is there right now, for example, if I had a cabin, is there a point where it becomes rental property? Is there a magic number of so many weeks to days where I have to report it now as far as income? And I don't understand the question. So if I rent it for 1 week, maybe nothing happens. If I rent it for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, does it kick in some other reporting or taxing that's necessary?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Norton, it's just an excellent question. That's why one of the reasons why we're doing this study. We lack a solid definition of what constitutes vacation rental property in Minnesota. We can't really point to a statute that says if you do it four times, there's no bright line. And so that's one of the reasons, and you'll notice in the language, we need to develop a definition of what it is so that people know what it is they're supposed to comply with. As to the taxing issue, that's going to vary, you know, by every individual taxpayer and how they want to treat that income. But we do know
that lodging establishments that hold themselves out as lodging establishments pay 6.5% sales tax on the lodging, and many of them pay a local lodging tax that is used for their convention visitors bureau. We think there are a number of facilities that are in the daily, nightly, and the daily, weekly, and lodging business that are not paying that tax right now, but we can't. We met with the Department of Revenue. They said, we don't know what the definition is. We don't know what to collect on that. So that's one of the reasons that we're looking at this study.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to ask. I've been told by someone that it was 2 weeks, and so I didn't know if there was actually a magic number, and apparently there isn't.
We've looked at some other states that have significant vacation property, like Florida, and so many times per month, and we don't think we have that clear of a definition for these individual units. And the point about the septic system is, one of the reasons we want to involve local governments, because it's a zoning issue as well. I mean, you buy a cabin and you don't really know that you're going to live next to a mini resort right next door that's being, it's being either rented out every week or even every night. So that is one of the reasons we included local units of government to get them involved in this issue as well.
Chief,
Representative
Maduri.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, will you also be doing this for a year, for an entire year? So looking at people that rent out their homes for the winter snowmobiling and ice fishing and that sort of thing. I know a lot of them put houses on lakes, but I'm imagining they still have a home base to go to at night. So is this a full year that you're looking at, or is it just a seasonal summer?
And Colleen's probably better able to address this than I am. However, it's not just a resorting issue. There are just as many of these in downtown Minneapolis that are used for shopping and that are rented out on a. It's not just a resorting issue. There's all kinds of tourism activities that properties are being rented for on an ongoing basis. So the answer is yes, but if I leave my cabin in, like I do in September, and I rent it to somebody until May, that's not what we're talking about. That's just rental. You're renting your house to somebody. We're talking about lodging establishments that are holding themselves out. They advertise on the internet. We can find them. We know what they are. We just don't know how they're regulated. So.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. do you mean we'd be asking just for rentals for the winter as well as summer? I mean, the study's not going to be seasonally specific. Yeah, we obviously, we have the same competition happening year round.
That's, Mr. Chair, that's my concern with that, because that's what I see as even a bigger issue. You have hunting season, and all of a sudden these little places that are, they're rented out 50 weeks out of the year, but if you're only looking for that one. Thank you.
Okay, any further discussion? Speaker Lenoffer, are you going to serve?
Good bill.
Okay.
We've also worked, and I know Tony Corlett is here on behalf of Hospitality Minnesota. We've been working with other tourism associations to advance this bill as well. I know that you're supposed to start.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one last comment. When I first was talking about this bill, I was interested in just making off anybody who rented their property part-time just comply with all the same rules and regulations that resorts did, and cooler minds have prevailed, and they recommended that just the study be done. So now I'll agree with them.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I would move that... Or Reverend Taylor, why don't you do it? You're the second author, I think.
I would move that bill. Yes.
Move it as be considered in the almost nihil good bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All those. Well, I guess we don't have to vote on it. Thank you.
It'll be in the bill. The chairman can call it whatever
you
want.
Okay. Thank you. We have a couple of minutes from February 21st and March 3rd. Let's say. Should we do it all together or just individually? February 21st.
Follow that.
Rosa Medori, move that the minutes be approved. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. March 3rd minutes.
I'll move those.
Representative Bly moves March 3rd minutes. Any discussion, questions?
Mr. Chairman, there's like a summary.
You can do it. Okay.
Good meeting.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. We're going to meeting once more when we decide that we haven't gotten the target. Yes. The governor has recommended the Centennial, and I have a minor in Latin too. That just doesn't sound right. Sounds more like six than 150. Okay. Okay, and he was pretty good to our committee. He hasn't recommended any cuts except one subject through one program that the city has been the state has been subsidizing for almost 20 years, the Target Center. That was done in early 1990s, I believe. I think $750,000. And the governor recommended $1 million for additional centennial program. Next meeting, I don't know, when do you think it is? Okay, it is going to be on the 19th, Wednesday, if we get the numbers, or on next Tuesday, because we're not going to be here on Monday, the 24th. So I guess it's going to be I'm told it's going to be at 2 o'clock. Either meeting will be at 2 o'clock, and probably in this room. Yeah. Any further questions? Thanks a lot for your participation. This is a late time. It's a nice turnout, so I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.